I'm going to think...
I didn't actually prepare... I mean, I have, like, basic ones I can ask him, but I didn't prepare anything at all interesting.
Yeah, I want to know what... If the guy who ends up feeling bad at the end...
Anwar,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but does he do anything after this process?
Mm.
Yeah. To atone, to be accountable? That would be my question.
Yeah. You mean, has he or will he? Or
has
should,
he
right?
since, you know, obviously the film yeah. ended, but then...
Yeah. Since... No, there's something I want to ask him, but I don't know if I'll blow the ending of the film. Because, but I want right. to talk to him about, he showed, I mean, maybe he showed Anwar the film. He has sort of a stunning description of what that was like.
Right.
But the ending of the film is such a gut punch.
Yeah.
Okay, that I don't want to. I mean, when I saw it, that's I was like, thanks. What are you, what's going on?
Okay,
but we can.
We're ready.
All right.
Enough about movies.
All right, so I'll start in a sec. Your phone's off, just in case.
My phone is silent, but I want to keep it on just in case
totally.
Alex gets back.
Okay.
And this is you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good afternoon and welcome to Beyond the Pale on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm Lizzie Ratner, here with my co-host Jesse Meyerson, who has recently joined the Beyond the Pale crew. Jesse is an independent journalist who has written for The Nation, Salon, In These Times, Truth Out, Alternet, Citizen Radio, and elsewhere. He's the author of Onward, an occupier's guide to understanding the current crisis. Jesse is filling in today for my usual co-pilot, Alex Kane, who's in Israel-Palestine. And in fact, we're going to talk to him a little bit later in this show about what he's seeing and experiencing there now. Anyhow, welcome to the crew, Jesse.
Thanks, Lizzie. I'm so excited to be here, not least because one of the few things that really binds me to the Jewish tradition is the holiday that begins tomorrow night at sundown, Pesach, which people in the U.S. often call Passover. It's the celebration of Jewish redemption and exodus from from Egyptian bondage. Don't worry about that.
It's both this year.
Do you want to say that just again?
Sure. I'll say that just again. It's the celebration of Jewish redemption and exodus from Egyptian bondage. So today on the show, we're going to present a sort of extended meditation on some of the themes that define Passover. Should I add back the
Oh yeah, do you have that?
I do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
And should I do it in the order that I originally proposed?
Which was him first, me, him. Why don't we? Yeah. Why don't we start
him
with that?
And
yeah,
then
yeah, yeah.
Triangle, shirtwaist, and
yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Lizzie, one reason I really like the Seder is the emphasis it places on living redemption through telling a collective story. Haggadah, the telling. First, we'll speak to filmmaker... Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know his name.
Joshua Oppenheimer.
Joshua Oppenheimer. I'm sorry, this is a...
This is the beauty of being able to edit.
And I'm not going to be editing, so you can... Yeah,
I'll be editing it. I'll get audio files from you.
Yeah, it's... we've got about 2 hours on this.
Okay.
Great.
If we need more, I got another card, but I'll just send you a link with the MP3s.
Fabulous.
And just let me know when you download it so I can take it off the
Sure.
site.
Sure.
Yeah, right, okay. Totally. So can you, Josh Oppenheimer.
Joshua Oppenheimer, the actor. Yeah. Okay. So I'll take that whole paragraph again. Lizzie, one reason I really like the Seder is the emphasis it places on living redemption through telling a collective story. Haggadah means the telling. So first on this episode, we'll speak to filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer, whose film The Act of Killing is a startling take on the Indonesian dissident purges of the mid-1960s. Some of the participants in the killing regime are confronting questions of redemption through telling their stories. And then in Egypt, the bondage that the Israelites were made to suffer, you at home may recall, was for the exploitation of the labor of a subordinated ethnic underclass, as Moses might have put it. So we're going to hear from Ruth Sergel about the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire and how remembering it can help us think about the labor predicament today. And then last, we'll be turning to where the escaped Israelites set out for in order to exercise God's promise to control a land. Our good friend Alex Kane has been covering President Obama's trip to Israel up close and can tell us how the Israelites' control of that land is working out. We'll ask him about the trip's implications for the Palestinian movement for redemption from Israeli occupation and bondage. It's going to be an exciting show. Stay with us.
Can I pause? I wonder, do you want to say Israelites the second time around? Just because I do worry about people being like...
Sure.
So I just said modern Israelis, but gotcha. I'm sorry, guys, for doing... Yeah, I just... I worry about the like...
I can do that, yeah. And last. Our good friend Alex Kane has been covering President Obama's trip to Israel up close and can tell us how the modern Israelis' control of that land is working out. We'll ask him about the trip's implications for the Palestinian movement for redemption from Israeli occupation and bondage. It's going to be a very exciting show. Stay with us.
This Monday, the same day Passover begins... Can I start again? God, what's... Now I'm like... This is not how we usually are. Okay. This Monday, the same day Passover begins, marks the 102nd anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, the deadliest industrial disaster in New York City history. It began around 4:40 in the afternoon, almost the exact same time that many of us will be getting ready for Passover tomorrow, and it claimed the lives of 146 workers. These workers were mostly Jewish and Italian immigrants and mostly women and girls between the ages of 16 and 23. The youngest was 14. The horror of the disaster helped galvanize a movement for health, safety, and workers' rights. It was a critical, critical turning point. And since 2004, volunteers with a street art project called Chalk have been fanning out across the city on the anniversary of the fire, inscribing the names and ages of the victims in front of their former homes. They do this in chalk. Why? Because according to a description of the project, the chalk will wash away, but the following year we return, insisting on the memory of these lost young workers. Well, here to talk to us today about this enormously moving annual ritual is Ruth Sergel, the artistic force behind the project. Ruth is an internationally recognized artist whose work harnesses technical prowess for community engagement and social transformation. Her work's been exhibited at the Museum of Modern Art, the Boston Museum of Fine Art, the Corcoran Gallery of Art, the National Museum of Women in the Arts, and so many more places. We're thrilled to have her on the program. Welcome, Ruth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to begin by just mentioning the fact that we are sitting on... in a building on Washington Place right now in modern-day New York, and we're just a few blocks directly down the street from the Ash Building on Washington Place where the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire took place 102 years ago. And I walked by there on my way to the studio today, and I looked up to the 8th, 9th, and 10th floor, and it's still enormously humbling and sort of horrifying to stand under that building. And so I wanted to know if you could tell us a little more about what happened 102 years ago during the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire.
Sure. Thanks for asking and for your interest in the project. 102 years ago, there was a fire on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of that building, just one block east of Washington Square Park. And 146 young workers were killed, and many, many of them could not get out of the building because the door was locked. And so many came out the windows, and people witnessed it, people including Frances Perkins, who went on to become the first female cabinet member. And I think one of the reasons it's so important in New York City history is that just prior to that, about a year and a half before, there had been a large strike, the Uprising of 20,000, where many of these same young women had gone on strike for better working conditions. And so when the fire happened, these bodies coming out of the window were, in a sense, a confrontation with New York about what they had or had not done to support that strike that had just ended a year earlier. And so I think today, when we look back at it, it's again a question of what we're willing to do to stand up for justice for ourselves and for our fellow citizens.
Can you tell us briefly why the doors were locked to the stairwells and to the, I guess, to the exits?
Yes. Well, there, We can't know for sure, but it was presumably to stop stealing. The owners said they had lost, I think, maybe up to $10 or $15 worth of materials.
That is intolerable.
And it's also that because of the strike that had happened, the owners of the Triangle Factory were particularly vehemently anti-union. And in fact, they organized an owners association to fight the strike. So their shop never settled. So they were trying to possibly also keep out union organizers.
And one more quick question about the fire. What were, and sort of the events preceding the fire, what were the conditions in the factory? What were the women who went on strike before the fire fighting against and struggling against?
Well, for its day, it was actually quite a modern factory. It was not the stereotype of a sweatshop, dark and horrible. It was quite modern, yet still it was completely unsafe, and for a variety of reasons. There was long, long tables. They never had a fire drill, even though they were told to have a fire drill. Fire sprinklers existed at that time, but they chose not to have them. So there's many things they could have done, but they chose not to do. The people who worked there worked incredibly long hours, really hard. They were absolutely the American dream. Immigrant generation working very hard to try to make a better life.
So tell us, why memorialize this event in this way with this art project that is ongoing year after year?
That's a good question. And I don't know. I think I'm a born and bred New Yorker, so I grew up with this story and I always wanted to make something about it. And but I found it very difficult to think of something to do that wasn't kind of schmaltzy and maudlin. And the reason I created chalk is I think it does two things. One, because you do have to do it each year. You know, we often say about tragedies, never again, and lest we forget. And then, of course, it always happens again. And so at a certain point, it becomes a little codependent. And I didn't want to participate in something false like that. And I think part of the zeitgeist of the time we're living in is we are very dissatisfied with how things are, and we don't know how to act on it. And we are searching for means. Old forms of protest don't necessarily work now, and new ones we're still exploring and trying to find what is actually effective. You know, my experience, you know, many people across the country marched to say they didn't want us to invade in Iraq, and the powers that be said, isn't that beautiful, democracy in action, and they just did exactly as they pleased. And I think we see that again and again. And so that my idea behind the project is that it's actually a very difficult step to go from this kind of inner realm of thought and feeling and how you perceive the world to the public realm of direct action. And going through the process of chalk, it's very public. You're by yourself on a city street. People very often will come and talk to you. But it's like building a muscle of progressive action for people to participate. And also that this memorial will in fact not exist if people don't remember each year.
Now, you go through the various different neighborhoods where these workers lived, and you do these memorials in front of their homes. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the people whom you're memorializing? What have you found out about them, and who were these women and 17 men?
Every year we learn a little bit more because now the people who chalk are sometimes descendants of the victims, sometimes people who live now in the building who sort of adopt the name that belongs to their building. And also people will contact me, and then I'm able to put them in touch with each other. So different family members who maybe didn't even know each other before. Most of them were extremely poor. A lot of times the young woman's wages were what was supporting the family at the time. And many, many of them, this was, they'd immigrated within the last few years to this country.
Are there any particular women's stories that stand out, or people's stories?
I think for me, the stories that are the most touching, perhaps, are the ones of siblings and relatives who were in the fire and having to live with that. Sometimes one sister, the case of Katie and Rosie Wiener, two sisters, and Rosie was killed and Katie survived. And you start to think about, well, did the oldest one look out, was looking for her because she felt responsible or not? I mean, we can't know for sure. But those are particularly sensitive. And Max and Sam Laird, two brothers who died. The Maltese family was a mother and two daughters who all were killed. All the women in that family were killed in that fire.
How long ago this happened can sort of foster in us an idea that these conditions have lapsed and we now live in a new and improved world. You know, as we mentioned, this led to a much bigger, this touched off a big period of labor agitation and agitation for health and safety in the workplace. But if we look at the labor conditions today, a lot, we see reverberations of these conditions all over. We see immigrants exploited direly under threat of deportation and night raids and being ripped apart from their families. We see women's work remaining extremely low wage, high levels of intensification of exploitation, you know, in home care, domestic work, nursing home workers, waitresses, emotional labor. And then we also see the garment industry, the actual factories shipped overseas where, you know, labor exploitation can be much more intense. So,
and as a, just as a side note, there was the fire in Bangladesh,
which
many people have compared to sort of a triangle shirtwaist fire-like moment or certainly happening.
That's right. So how can memorializing these young women help us understand or help us confront the labor predicament we find ourselves in today?
Yeah, well, I think absolutely that the Triangle Dead of today are in Bangladesh and Pakistan. And, you know, our contemporary Clara Lumleks are people like Kalpona Akhtar in Bangladesh, who's fighting with the Bangladesh Solidarity Center there. Now, actually, we've started for the last few years chalking the names of the Bangladeshi dead in front of the brown ash building where the fire took place. And it's a small gesture, but it's one way that we try to keep in touch. And I also do outreach with sweat-free communities and the International Labor Rights Forum to find out information each year that I also share with all the chalkers who are participating, because also a lot of classes participate in chalk. And so I forward them information about contemporary issues. But I think, I mean, the problem is, and I think this is the broader problem, is that we need to be organizing internationally, and that's, you know, capital is international, and so our organizing has to be international at this point. And it's trying to find ways to bridge those, because traditional labor has struggled to make that leap. And I think as educators and activists and artists, we can help move the movement in that way. Hopefully. And, you know, so for example, for the centennial of the Triangle Fire, the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition made a calendar of all the events happening all across the country to commemorate it. And on the cover, we had Clara Lumleks and Kalpona Akhtar and mirrored them, sort of mirror images of each other.
Pause for one sec. This is amazing. This is amazing. But I do feel like, for the sake of our, we should probably
let's have one wrap up question.
Yeah.
Go for it.
I'm not sure I actually have. I have sort of a cheesy wrap up question. But do you have a?
What's the cheesy wrap up?
It's something about Jewishness. But I
do that one.
But Ruth, you are Jewish.
People always ask me this. I am Jewish. No. I'm the worst Jew in New York.
Hard.
Yeah, very, yeah. Very difficult for me to believe that.
Yeah. No, I assumed you were, but I just... all right, let me think of how to frame the questions.
Frame it through Passover.
No, yeah, I am...
Oh, yeah, I have an answer. I have an answer even before the question, so that's
good. What's your answer? What do you want to...
Well, I think there's something interesting that actually the owners of the Triangle Fire
were Jewish. Yeah.
And so when we talk about issues of Israel and blah, 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 like it actually does have a reverberation today for us way somehow.
And now we just have time for one more question. And the question really taps into the kind of the Jewish resonance of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. Many of the young women and men who were killed in the fire were Jewish. And within many Jewish circles, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire is primarily an enormously tragic moment, evoking an enormously hard scrabble past where you had immigrants coming from Europe, from the sort of the horrors and Egypt, if you want to continue the Passover metaphor of Europe, to the United States, seeking a better life here and finding really oppressive conditions. And so this is very much part of our legacy and tradition, as is sort of what came out of it, the extraordinary organizing that helped, I don't want to say give birth, but certainly helped foment a lot of the labor agitation that followed and that led to enormously important changes from the 40-hour work week to very basic labor protections. So I guess I want to ask you about sort of how you hooked into this from a Jewish perspective. What is the Jewish resonance of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire for you and how, yeah.
Well, I think we have, you know, a tradition to be really proud of. And when you look at the people who were fighting in 1911, the Clara Lemlechs, the Rose Schneidermans, I mean, those are really women for the ages that are role models for me and for many others. From a contemporary perspective, though, I think we can also have a bit of a broader point of view in that also the owners were Jewish and they were strivers, just sort of one generation ahead of their workers. And in fact, their irresponsibility caused the death of all these people. And to me, that is a parable for today, right now, as we, as American Jews, are struggling with our thoughts and feelings about Israel and Israel's place in the world. And that's a really complicated issue and really hard. And I think it's really changing right now, from when I grew up as a little girl to how we see it now and what possibilities there might be and what happens if sometimes we're good and sometimes we're not so good and how do we take responsibility for that? Because we like to imagine 100 years ago we would have been on the right side of history. But of course, our real responsibility is to be on the right side of history today.
Thank you, Ruth, so much for coming by.
Yeah, thank you, Ruth Sergel, for joining us today. And to our audience, just a reminder, you're listening to Beyond the Pale on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. Before we continue with our regular programming, we're going to spend a few minutes begging. That's right. We're going to get down on our knees right here in the studio. We're doing it right now, getting on our knees. I see Jesse. He's getting on his knees. Ouch. I'm getting on my knees. Yeah, it hurts.
My knees hurt so much.
And we're going to get ready to beg you for your assistance. And the particular assistance that we need right now is, as many of you listeners probably know, WBAI is faced with a financial crisis at the moment. And we are trying to save the transmitter that broadcasts all this valuable, valuable programming to people throughout New York City every day. And so we're asking you, our listeners, to get on the phone and to make a contribution to WBAI. You can also do it on our website, WBAI.org, and make a contribution that will go specifically to the fund set up for listeners to help prevent WBAI radio from complete shutdown. And by helping us meet the rising accumulated costs of our transmitter at the Empire State Building, you assure that WBAI will continue to be on the air.
We're already in a difficult position in terms of our home base, which we have lost. And there's so that's why we're here on Washington Place. And there's a bunch of different satellite areas where people are recording from. But we can stay on the air. We can make that work and we can come back from that if only we can retain the transmitter. There are a number of things making it very difficult for us to retain the transmitter. The 2008 economic collapse did not do WBAI any favors. Of course, the devastation from Hurricane Sandy shut down all of downtown, including forcing BAI to leave our excellent studio there on Wall Street. We've got a lot facing us, but number one thing, that the most important thing that we can do right now is retain access to our transmitter.
It'd be on their website.
Oh, 3602.
3602.
Is that it? That's the call center. Is that the call center? Okay.
That's it.
Yeah. Okay. So now thank you, Jesse. And the way that you can begin doing this, the way that you can help keep BAI broadcasting, sending its important news across the city, is to call and make a donation. And you can call the following number, 516 516-620-3602. One more time. That's 516-620-3602. Now, if you are unable to make it to the phone right at this very moment, you also have a number of other ways that you can give. We want you to go to the phone. We think you should go to the phone, but we also think it would be fantastic if you participated in the Emergency Transmitter Fund online art auction. This started March 19th, and it's going to continue through April 1st. So we have just about another week of this. And to participate in the art auction, you go to wbaiauction.org. That's wbaiauction.org to bid on artwork from painting to photography to works on paper. And there's fantastic stuff online. So we encourage you to go check out the WBAI art auction in addition to calling that number I mentioned,
516-620-3602. Again, that's 516-620-3602. Your generosity is very, very valuable.
And that does it for this pitching session. There will be another. We're going to go to a quick music break. We'll be back in a moment. Stick around. Oh my God, all of a sudden we're Crazy Eddie. Like,
Crazy Eddie, I love that.
Yeah, because you grew up in New York, you know, yes, Crazy Eddie.
I forgot two
I'm
things.
So sorry. Oh, that we, yeah, oh, that well, we had you stay there while we were doing that. Yeah.
And I'm too much, yeah. I know you have a real time crunch, but let me just tell you what they are. Yeah. Tell me if we need them. I totally spaced, and here you are saying we're at the address, blah, blah, blah. The Memorial Design Competition is open right now. To design a memorial that will be on the freaking building.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool, sure. Yeah.
And I was an idiot when I didn't do it. And the other thing is, and this also could come from you if you have time to say that if people want to participate
right.
in chalk.
No, we should have
just
you say
go
it.
To the website. I should say it?
Yeah, you should. You should. No, you should say it. You should say it. Totally. Okay. You should say it.
That they should go to the website. And okay. They should.
All right, so I'm going to just ask how people can get involved in this project,
and
you
then
can
say
both of those
quickly.
Things.
Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Sure. We rolling? Yeah. So, Ruth, tell listeners how they can get involved in this project if they want to.
Thanks for asking. If people want to participate in chalk, you can contact me through my website, streetpictures.org, streetpictures.org. And also, everyone should know that there is going to be a Triangle Fire Memorial on the building where the fire took place, just one block east of Washington Square Park. And at this moment, the design competition is open, and I really encourage people to come up with bold ideas and please submit them. And if they want to submit, remember the trianglefire.org is the website, and all the information is there. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay. Fantastic. That was great. Thank you.
Good.
I'm sorry.
No,
I was flustered, but you were great. That was really wonderful. So I'm excited. I live in the East Village, so I always see,
good.
You know, these wonderful
the project.
No, it's not crazy. Every year I sort of look out for it because, you know, it resonates through the ages. And I think you see a woman's name, you pause, you think about her.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
It sort of does. It kind of changes, I hope.
Yeah, no, it's great. So I should let me accompany you out upstairs and then I'll come back down. Any news from Alex? Jesse Meyerson, who's co-hosting with me today.
Hi, Josh.
Okay. Hi.
And we're going to thank you, Josh, for doing this. I'm so happy to have you on. And
you're welcome.
And one quick question. Everything got a little bit screwed up around here. Could you give me, and I couldn't actually get your bio before we, in full business mode. What do you want me to just say, like a sentence or two for your bio?
I mean, just say that I'm a fiction, I'm a filmmaker working originally from the U.S. but living in Denmark. My films include, do you know the titles of them, Lizzie?
The Globalization Tapes.
The entire history of the Louisiana Purchase. You can put in, add like, what the bio said.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get it.
I'm sorry. You know, my phone.
Spend more time on the awards. Cause that's
what I'll do that.
So
yeah.
The awards are. Drama, the Audience Award for Best Documentary.
Right. And there are so many, I probably won't mention them all.
Yeah, the Danish Academy Award for Best Documentary is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
The grand prize of the Copenhagen Documentary Festival.
I should be writing this down.
Probably enough.
Okay.
There's 12 of them.
That's freaking amazing, Josh. So, wait. Okay. The Panorama.
There's the best film at the Prague One World Festival. No.
Yeah. Panorama Audience Award. So, hold on. You know what happened is we were, well, whatever. It's not even interesting what happened. And sorry to waste time with this.
And my bio, if you want me to, just one more. Let's see. Do you want more prizes, or is that plenty?
That's good. No, I'm sorry, but you know what?
Are we going on?
No, in 2 seconds. But you know what? I was, because I have the list here, and then I wasn't writing them, so I just want. So the Panorama Audience Award for Best Documentary. Yeah, the Danish Academy Award.
Danish Academy Award.
The
special prize of the Danish film critics. I don't know. You can leave that one out. It's weird.
Okay.
Grand prize in Copenhagen and Prague film festivals.
Okay.
The Audience Award in Mexico City. I don't know.
Okay. All right. This will be, and then I'll just say, and on and on and on.
Josh, for audio's sake, would you speak somewhat loudly into the phone?
Yeah, of course. Is this? I don't know how loud the phone. Is that better?
That's perfect.
Okay.
All right. So, Josh, we're gonna go in like 2 seconds. Give me 1 second here, just to get myself organized.
Okay.
Josh, I'm going to ask you to just, I'm going to do a very brief description of the film, but I'm going to ask you to mostly describe it, because it's a complicated film and you will do it much better justice than I will.
Actually, I'm not so good at, to be honest.
Really?
I usually am interviewed by people who've seen the film.
Okay, so they like...
I've never been asked to do that.
Oh, no.
I'm usually asked to talk about how I got into it or...
Okay. I mean, I was just going to say, I'm doing something.
I can do it, but I don't know that I'll be that brief.
That's okay. I'm going to give like a 2 or 3 sentence description of it. And then this is not live, obviously. So we can always edit things down. No, it's not live.
Great. That's so nice to know. Okay. Then it's fine.
Yeah. It's not live. So if you get lost in the weeds, which I doubt you will. And I might get lost in tons of weeds here today, so
yeah. I forgot, of course it's not live because you gave me a choice as to the time.
No, but that's fine. Okay,
this
so
I've been doing. My schedule is like someone's played a nasty joke.
I can't even imagine. Wait, actually, Josh, where are you? Right, you're at the Hague now. Where are you?
I'm in the Hague.
Wow, wild.
But yesterday I was in France.
Oh my god, you must be going nuts.
The day before in London.
And then you were in Texas before that, right?
Before that in Texas. Tomorrow to New York.
It's crazy.
Wednesday to Hong Kong.
Oh, my God.
And it's every day is full of interviews from like 8 in the morning. I just got 400 unread emails. I'm just...
Jesus, yesy. Oh, my God. Okay.
But I'm so happy to hear this isn't live.
All right. So this is like so low key and low pressure. And this is just fun. This is you and me. So I'm excited. All right. So in 2 seconds...
I'll call you, Yuzula.
No, you can call me. I'm going to have to... I'll say that we're friends for obvious reasons. Okay.
Phone right up, good and close.
Okay, Jeff, our engineer, is saying phone right up, good and close. All right,
Right up.
Great. So we're going to start in 2 seconds. Welcome back to Beyond the Pale on 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm Lizzie Ratner here with today's co-host, my special co-host today, Jesse Meyerson. As we continue our theme today of redemption from oppression, and particularly the stories that people tell to make sense of traumatic events and a traumatic past, we're going to turn to a remarkable film called The Act of Killing. It's a film that's making its way around the globe right now from film festival to film festival, and it's going to be coming to New York City this weekend, this Saturday and Sunday. Actually, let me repeat. Sorry, you know what? I messed up the times, Josh, because we're actually... Fuck.
Don't you worry.
Right, so let me start that again, because we're going... this will actually air after the Saturday show is gone.
Oh.
So, sorry, that's why I want to fix that, so that people, though, can come to the Sunday show.
Yeah.
Sorry, so let me just start that again. Okay.
Don't worry.
Welcome back to Beyond the Pale. What is it, Jeff?
The creaking of the chair, sorry.
Oh, no, that's totally fine. Okay, this is...
Welcome
back to Beyond the Pale on 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm Lizzie Ratner, here with a special co-host today, my new co-host today, Jesse Meyerson. As we continue looking at our theme of redemption from oppression, and more particularly the stories that people tell themselves to make sense of a traumatic past, we're going to turn to an extraordinary film, a remarkable film called The Act of Killing, that's currently making its way around the globe from film festival to film festival, and that's going to be coming to New York, that actually played last Saturday night in New York for the first time, and will be playing this afternoon, Sunday, for its second and final showing here before it comes back again in the summer. The film... is a little indescribable, but in a very small nutshell, it's about the Indonesian genocide of 1965-66, U.S.-backed, it's worth mentioning. It's about American movie-making, evil, impunity, human nature, and the rot that leaches through a society when perpetrators are not held responsible for their crimes. Another way of saying what it's about is to say that it's about a gang of cinema-obsessed former Death Squad leaders who attempt to relive their glory days by making an American-style film about their exploits during the genocide. It's a film so stunning that Werner Herzog, who signed on as executive producer, said of the film, "I have not seen a film as powerful, surreal, and frightening in at least a decade. It's unprecedented in the history of cinema." Here to talk to us about the film today is the film's director, Joshua Oppenheimer, who is an American-born and raised film director who's now living in Copenhagen. He's also made the Globalization tapes and another film called The Entire History of the Louisiana Purchase. I should also say one more final thing about The Act of Killing before we bring Josh on, and that is that the film has been winning awards all over. It won the Panorama Audience Award for Best Documentary at the Berlin International Film Festival. It won the Danish Academy Award, the Grant Award, the Grand Prize in Copenhagen and Prague, and the Audience Award at FICUNAM in Mexico City, and tons of other prizes. So it is a huge honor to have Josh on with us today to talk about The Act of Killing. Welcome to Beyond the Pale, Josh.
Thank you so much, Lizzie.
Now, I have to say one more thing before we really dive in, which is just a bit of full disclosure for the audience, which is that Joshua is a good friend of mine, and we go way back. But that is actually not why I'm interviewing him today. I'm interviewing him because I saw this film about 8 months ago, and it blew me away, and I think about it still probably once a day, because it has left such a deep and strong and lasting impression. So with that in mind, Joshua, can you begin? It's very weird to call you Joshua. I'm just going to have to call you Josh. Josh, can you begin telling us about The Act of Killing? What is this film that is getting so many people talking and has gotten into so many people's minds?
It's a film in which I work with a group of seemingly unrepentant death squad leaders who've helped commit genocide, who rule over the society where they killed people. I work with them so that they can reenact their memories of genocide and dramatize their feelings about what they've done as a way of exposing what happens to us collectively and to them as individuals when we build our normality on the basis of terror and lies. In a nutshell.
In a very small nutshell. And so how did you come to make this film? It's not kind of a film you just stumble on around the corner.
No, that's right. Part of it stems from my own views about filmmaking and my own what I am as a filmmaker. I never identified really as a documentary filmmaker per se. In fact, I feel whenever we film anybody, we are actually creating reality with the people we film. So if I film a little child go to school, actually the event in the child's day, the big event, is being filmed, is the filming, not school. And then together with the child in the classroom, we simulate a reality in which we're not present in a normal documentary. And in fact, that's fiction. It's a fictional reality because we are present. And if we're going to be creating reality anyways with the people we film, I feel it's really the filmmaker's duty to create the reality which is most insightful to the most urgent issues inherent in the situation. So in about a decade ago, I was working in a collaborative vein, working collaboratively with a community of survivors in Indonesia. I was living in this community trying to break really a 40-year silence about what had happened in the genocide in 1965-66, trying to work with them to tell the story of what happened to them and to expose also a regime of impunity and fear which had been in place in this community and across Indonesia ever since, a regime in which survivors were not allowed to marry who they wished without they had to get permission from the army to marry people, and they were often denied the right to marry who they wished. They were denied access to all the good jobs. They were denied access to higher education. They were forced to do regular forced unpaid labor for the military and for local for plantation companies, often American-owned plantation companies. Goodyear was using basically free slave labor on its plantation in North Sumatra. And they were forced to regularly give money to local officials who knew they were afraid of them and so could extort them. And working together with members of this community, we were trying to expose what had happened to them and how they were still living in a regime of fear. And every time we would film together, the army would arrive or the police would arrive or the village mayor would arrive within a few minutes and stop us. They would take our equipment, they would arrest us, they would detain members of my crew, and it was scary for the crew and it was terrifying for the people with whom I was collaborating and with whom I was living and who I felt were my extended family in North Sumatra. And so we kind of regrouped. We went back to the broader Indonesian human rights community and asked, is there some way of, can we get some backup or protection so that we can safely make this film? How can we make this film? Should we not make this film? And everybody said, no, you must make this film. You can't abandon this. We need to expose, we need to break the silence about what happened and expose the nature of the impunity and the terror in which we're living. And so quitting wasn't an option. And then one of the women in this village I was living, whose aunt was killed, suggested, you know, Josh, perhaps the safest way and the best way to do this is to film the perpetrators themselves. And she suggested that I start with my next door neighbor in this village who had killed her aunt.
Wow.
She said, go film him. He will welcome you in. He will appear to be proud of what he did. And I say appear because she already, I think, intuited that they as human beings can't really be proud of what they did. They will appear to be proud of what they did. They will boast about it. They will show off about it. They will invite you to the places where they killed and offer to reenact it. She sort of understood that this is what they would do because this is what they do in their own communities to their own victims' relatives. And she said, film that, and the audience will see at once why we're so afraid. They'll see at once the nature of the regime of fear in which we live. So starting with my next-door neighbor, I filmed every killer I could find and found that my friend was correct, that they were all boastful and seemingly remorseless, and they were all falling over themselves virtually to show me what they did, not just to tell me about it, but to show me. And I realized there were two two stories here, both of world historical importance, I felt. First of all, is what happened in the genocide in 1965. There had been some documentation of other regions of Indonesia, but here I was in the plantation belt of North Sumatra, where no one had documented what happened, and I was seeing that tens of thousands, swift arithmetic would tell me that tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people had been killed in this one region, and no one had documented it. And within a few years, as these men would grow even older and would die, the facts about what happened would become irritrevable. They would be lost.
And
so
I want to interrupt for 1 second just to add that, of course, in the United States, this isn't, you know, the Indonesian genocide is an enormous, enormous event, and so many people in our country are completely ignorant of it. And it's an event in which our country played a role of sorts. So I just wanted to add that for the audience.
Absolutely. I mean, in 1965, the U.S. government actively supported the killings. They provided death lists of thousands of names, basically insisting, kill these people if you want aid to build the new dictatorship. And they provided aid. The U.S. and Britain were the biggest, were the people who really paid for the Suharto dictatorship and paid for the military there. The U.S. provided weapons, money, and intelligence to propaganda to justify the genocide. So basically, the U.S. I'll just repeat that. The U.S. provided weapons and money for the army to use in implementing the genocide, and provided propaganda to justify it in the eyes of the world and to the Indonesian people. So when people ask me, as they often do after seeing the film, what can we do about this? There's a lot that foreign countries can do about this if their foreign policy was genuinely interested in preventing crimes against humanity, as opposed to serving as a kind of armed service of the Chamber of Commerce, or an armed wing of the Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
But I first remind people, look, when you ask the question of what the U.S. can do, you first have to recognize that the genocide, the military dictatorship that followed, the regime of fear and terror in which Western companies are free to use gangsters to break strikes and kick people off their land, that is the West's vision for Indonesia.
Hmm.
So going back to how I came into this, shall I?
Yes, absolutely. I was going to loop you back there, but you're doing it. So yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So after where was I? Where did I leave?
Well, actually, you know, one thing I was going to say is you left off, you'd been talking about a little bit about how boastful the perpetrators were when you went door to door and started interviewing them, and how excited they were to be part of this film. And I have to say, having seen the film a couple times, it never fails to shock me, the boastfulness of these men who committed mass murder, and the seeming pride. And what, among the many things that's so startling about the film, is the way it conveys an extraordinarily human and artistic form the dangers of what happens to a society when the victors are the perpetrators, and when, because of that, their story gets elevated and there's absolutely no accountability for the crimes that were committed. And I know I'm jumping around here a little bit, but at some point, I would love you to loop. Actually, you know what? I'm going to actually hold off on that, Josh. Sorry. I was going to jump ahead to the U.S. role, to the U.S. again. I'll hold off on that. I'll just wrap up the previous thing. And so when we edit, it will sound all nice and neat. And so you were talking, and so I continue to be struck by the boastfulness of the perpetrators.
Exactly. So as I found that every perpetrator I filmed, I felt that it was my duty to film the perpetrators, but I was also, because I wanted to not, that's where I was, about not losing the facts.
Right? Yes, that's where you were, and I'm so sorry I interrupted you during that for you.
I also felt that it was...
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, Josh. Josh, can you speak a little bit louder? I'm so sorry. I'm just getting cues here. I'm sorry. Okay.
I also felt that it was essential to try and understand it. Sorry, I know how to, I want to say this. In the perpetrator's boasting, I also saw, though, a story that wasn't about what happened in 1965, but rather how the past is kept alive and used and abused in the present, how a regime of terror and corruption and violence was built on the celebration of genocide by perpetrators who have remained in power ever since. And I was asking critically questions of the imagination, how, as these men would boast to me, as they would tell me horrible things in front of their loved ones, in front of their family members, how do they want their family members to see them? How do they want me to see them? How do they want the world to see them? And as I met more and more of these perpetrators and understood that they were not actually inhuman monsters, but ordinary people, I increasingly wanted to know, how do they really see themselves? And so when I followed a chain of command following the I filmed all the perpetrators I could find in the region, and then I started moving up the chain of command to the city of Medan, the fourth biggest city in Indonesia, where I made the act of killing, where I met Anwar Kongo, the main character in the act of killing. He was the 41st killer that I filmed. And I was fascinated. And I realized that if I let these men, I realized that all of the killers who I was filming were falling over themselves to show me what they did, to take me to the places where they killed, to reenact it for me, and then they would, after reenacting it, lament that they hadn't brought machetes, they hadn't brought as props, they hadn't brought friends along to play victims. And I came to realize, if I let them, simply let them do what it is they seem inclined to do, let them show me what they did, let them dramatize it, let them reenact it in whatever ways they wished, and if I document the process and combine the footage of their making of and preparing their dramatizations and the dramatizations themselves, together we would create a new form of documentary. This would create a new form of documentary, a kind of documentary of the imagination rather than a documentary of everyday life. And it would show, it would answer these fundamental questions. How do they want to be seen, and how do they really see themselves? And in fact, that's really what I proposed to them. I could be very open about asking them what they did, how did they kill, how did they exterminate, because for them, in their context, these words had heroic connotations. So I could say straight, directly, show me how you exterminated the communists in this village. And exterminated wasn't a word that evoked Holocaust, it was a word that evoked heroism. So then I could say, look, you've done something enormous. You've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history. Your entire society is based on it. Your lives have been shaped by what you've done. Go ahead and dramatize it in whatever way you wish for me. Make scenes that show your feelings about it or show what you did. I will film the process. I will use your scenes. I will help you make the scenes as powerful as possible, consistent with your vision and with your crew and your friends, making them, writing them, acting in them. And I will combine all this material, and together we'll make a new form of film that really has never been made before, and that will show the meaning of what you've done to yourselves and to your society. And that's what we did.
I have so many questions to follow up from that, and we don't have a ton of time, so I'm going to sort of try to lay them out fairly quickly. And so one of the questions is, you know, in making this film of the imagination, it becomes very clear that American projections of their own selves and identity have become very much interwoven in Indonesian projections or imaginings of themselves, specifically in the form of American movies, which the people you end up filming, Anwar Kongo and his sidekicks and compatriots, they were all, before they became mass murderers, they were cinema thugs, people who hung out outside theaters in Medan, and were thugs. and they were obsessed with American movies, correct? And so I want to know if you could talk a little bit about the intertwining of the American imagination, or as projected through American film, and this other imagination that's being created and been created, this fantasy world, fantasy life.
The characters in my film were movie theater gangsters. That's their own term, preman bioskop in Indonesian. They hung out in cinemas. They used movie theaters as their base of operations, also for much bigger crimes, but they also hung out in the cinemas and sold tickets, on scalped movie tickets, as a kind of smaller source of income. And they loved American movies. And they saw, at the time, they saw the communists as sort of, and the left in general, as being traditionalists, uncivilized, not understanding. They saw themselves as suave and urbane and metropolitan. And I think in 1965, before the killings, the left was boycotting American movies. In fact, because the head of the American Motion Picture Association in Indonesia, a guy named Bill Palmer, they found in his villa in Jakarta a memorandum outlining a plan to overthrow the socialist president of Indonesia, Sukarno. It's called the Gilchrist Memorandum. And for this reason, all of Indonesia thought, oh my gosh, the distributor of American movies in Indonesia is actually plotting to kill our president, the founder of independent Indonesia, and so they boycotted American movies. And it turns out that the Gilchrist Memorandum may have been a forgery, but that's what Indonesians believed, and there was this boycott, and they were also trying to support an indigenous Indonesian cinema, post-colonial cinema, so that the screens would not just be filled with exported Hollywood films. But the movie theater gangsters loved the Hollywood films, and the Hollywood films were the most profitable and popular at the box office. And so this boycott meant that the gangsters hated the left, the whole left, and it pitted them against each other. And so when the genocide began and the army was looking for civilians to run death squads to do some of the dirty work, also so that the army could deny some of the worst excesses during the genocide, they could say that it was civilians acting on their own initiative, it was logical that the army would look to people with a proven capacity for violence, the movie theater gangsters, and to in particular to the movie theater gangsters, because they already hated the communists and the Indonesian left.
And is it true that that Anwar and his colleagues, if you will, sort of use some American movies as inspiration in their methods for killing people?
Yeah, that's right. Because Anwar's death squad was hanging out in the cinema, Anwar's gang was hanging out in the cinema, the army built the death squad office right across the street, so it would be convenient for Anwar and his friends to actually kill people. It wouldn't interfere too much with their lives in the cinema. So Anwar and his friends would come out of the movies late at night, walk across the street, and kill people in ways inspired by whatever movie they'd seen. Now, I think this is—it's really important here to recognize that Anwar talks about getting his methods of killing from gangster movies. He liked to kill people with wire, garroting them with wire, because it was relatively bloodless, and that was something that he saw in gangster movies. It's where he got the idea. But I don't think that means that movie violence begets real life violence. As I said, Anwar was the 41st perpetrator that I filmed, and the first 30 were in the countryside cutting off people's heads with machetes, and they were drinking to distance themselves from the act of killing. Mm-hmm. I think that Anwar says something else in the film. He says that he would walk out of an Elvis Presley musical inspired, swept up by the, intoxicated by the mood of the film, dance his way across the street and kill people happily. Elvis Presley musicals are not violent, but they are stupid. And I think that what we have to beware of is not so much movie violence, but escapism. The way we use storytelling to escape from our most bitter and indigestible truth. Huh. And I think somehow Anwar was using acting, inspired by the movies that he saw, as a way of distancing himself from the act of killing. So acting was always part of the act of killing. And in fact, I think that's the real reason why Anwar participates in the film. Not to glorify what he did, or not to give himself a positive image, but to somehow escape from the horror of what he did. I think we're used to seeing perpetrators of genocide. We're used to seeing perpetrators either deny what they've done or apologize for it. That's because almost invariably when we're interviewing perpetrators, they've been overthrown. They've been removed from power. The Nazis lost. The Khmer Rouge were kicked out when the Vietnamese invaded. The Hutu extremists lost. These men have won. And I think given the chance, no human being who is killed will, on their own volition, admit that what they've done is wrong, because if they have a chance to justify it. Because once you admit that it's wrong, how can you live with yourself? How can you wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and go about your day knowing that you've destroyed hundreds of or thousands of lives just out of greed or the desire for the in pursuit of power and money? Anwar, and this is sort of the central paradox, I think, in the act of killing. We see, and I saw as a filmmaker, these killers celebrating genocide as a symptom of their impunity, which undoubtedly it is. But I think at first one assumes it's also a symptom of their lack of remorse. And on the contrary, I think that the justification of genocide, the celebration of genocide, is actually a symptom of their, something they know, at least in their bodies, at some level, that they all know that it was wrong. I think that they justify what they've done so that they can live with themselves. What seems to be a lack of remorse is actually a symptom of their humanity. And the horror, the really dangerous and unfortunate thing, is that once you justify what you've done and even celebrate what you've done, then it allows you, and once you're corrupted by having done it, then it allows you to do it again. And it allows you to continue to commit evil, even though the justification itself is a symptom of the fact that you know that it was wrong. So these men justify what they did. They become addicted to government propaganda, blaming their victims, essentially saying the victims had it coming. And they justify what they did, and they celebrate what they did to reassure themselves that it's okay. But then those stories, that celebration of genocide, becomes an instrument of fear that they can use to intimidate the survivors and to continue to oppress them and to kill again. So in a sense, these men go on a downward spiral in which they destroy themselves. And I think by the end of the act of killing, you see that, yes, these men have escaped justice, but no, they haven't escaped punishment.
Wow, Josh, thank you so much for spending so much time with us talking about the act of killing. I have so many more questions I want to ask, but time prevents us today. So thank you.
You need to repeat that. I've just interrupted you.
Oh, that's fine. Well, no. No, that's fine. I mean, I do want to, as a side note while I'm talking, I did want to ask you about, like, the Holocaust and stuff like that, but...
I can just say that quickly.
Yeah,
all right.
We actually have somebody, it's terrible. We have somebody actually who's waiting for us for our final interview. So let me start the wind out again, and then we'll
have him back on.
We'll have you back. We'll have you back on when the film comes in. That's what we'll do. Simple. Okay. So, unfortunately, Josh, we have to wind up the interview now, which breaks my heart a little bit because there are so many more questions I want to ask you. But now we just have an excuse to have you back on when the film comes out in the summer in theaters everywhere. But for audience members who are listening, we were just talking about an extraordinary film called The Act of Killing, and it will be playing this afternoon at 2 p.m. at the Walter Reed Theater as part of the new director's New Films Film Festival. And there might be a few tickets left, so I encourage you to run out and go see the film. Thank you for joining us, Joshua Oppenheimer, director of the extraordinary film, The Act of Killing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Josh, thank you so much. I wanted to ask you 1,000 more questions, but that was great.
Don't worry. I'm you're also getting me after like 11 hours straight of
talking. Yeah. So I'm
and we're gonna edit this down, and then I'll send you a link to the show and everything. But Josh, thank you.
Lots of
love, and I'm gonna see you on Sunday morning, right?
Yeah, Sunday morning. Yeah.
I can't wait, and then we can talk about seeing each other more. All right, giant hug, lots of smooches. Bye.
Big hug.
Bye. Big hug. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I was getting